Hello, my name's Adam Smith, and welcome to The Last Best Hope, the podcast with a question mark at the end of its title. Why has Abraham Lincoln's phrase about America as the last best hope of Earth resonated with so many people over the generations? And has that hope now died? There's a long tradition of foreigners travelling across America and trying to make sense of it. Charles Dickens thought it tawdry. James Bryce found it complex and resilient. Lord Charnwood, a liberal peer and masterful biographer of Lincoln, thought it inspiring. In more recent decades, some of these interpreters have been BBC correspondents.
I sailed back on the Queen Mary with a couple of thousand GI brides.
Throughout the whole of the Cold War, Alistair Cook's weekly Letter from America provided British radio listeners with wry updates from the heart of the indisputable protector of the free world, while 1960s BBC TV viewers watched plummy English reporters bemused by hippies or confused by black power activists.
In this tragic summer of 1967, has come news of violence across America.
Often, the subtext of foreign reporting has been an eye-rolling only in America. But sometimes, as when Obama was elected president in 2008, for example, foreign observers have been seduced by America's apparently unquashable capacity to offer the bright light of hope after even the darkest night. And always, what happens in America seems to matter. The latest, and in my view, one of the best books in this genre of British observers interpreting the meaning of America, is by Nick Bryant. And it's called When America Stopped Being Great, A History of the Present. Nick Bryant is the BBC correspondent in New York. He read history at Cambridge, has a DPhil in American politics from Oxford, and has also reported for the BBC from Asia and Australia, as well as the US.
A week before Inauguration Day, it's usually an air of expectancy that you'll find on Capitol Hill, where next Friday they'll be playing Hail to the Chief as Donald Trump takes centre stage.
Reading Nick's book is a bit like watching a vivid highlights package of the last 40 years of US history, from the optimism of Reagan's Morning in America ad in 1984 to the dystopianism of the attack on the Capitol on January the 6th, 2021. And along the way, Nick recounts often with first-hand reporting the bathos of Clinton's presidency, the Gingrich revolt, the confusion after 9/11, the congressional gridlock, the polarization, the conspiracy theorizing, the racial division. And Nick Bryant joins me now. Nick, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Adam, it's absolutely lovely to be here. And of course, I was one of those correspondents that was seduced at a very early age by the magic of America, yeah, and the promise of America.
I've just said that your book is like a highlights package of the American story since the 80s. But another way of putting it is that it also reads like a love story gone wrong. You know, there are two protagonists in this book, aren't there? There's America and there's you. And it starts well and it ends well, if not badly, then at least on a note of anxiety. We'll come back to that anxiety, but let's just start with what seduced you about America in the beginning.
Adam, I arrived in America, an extraordinary moment. I was 16 years old. My grandma had just died, actually. She gave me a small amount of money, just enough to purchase a flight ticket to California. And I took a solo visit, the first time I'd ever traveled without my parents. I was so keen to get to America. And I arrived in Los Angeles on the eve of the Olympics, that extraordinary summertime of resurgence when, after the long national nightmare of Vietnam and Watergate and the Iranian hostage crisis, America really got its mojo back with that extraordinary modern-day gold rush. You'll remember the opening ceremony, 84 pianists bashing out Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue on 84 pianos, a rocket man jetting into the LA Coliseum. It was just so American, just so Hollywood. Only a country like this could have pulled that off. And of course, later in that year, Ronald Reagan wins re-election with that slogan that just perfectly captured the optimistic spirit of the time. He won 49 out of 50 states. Had it not been for a few thousand votes in Minnesota, he would have got the 50-50 Electoral College sweep. And the slogan was, of course, "It's morning again in America."
Nick, your book is called When America Stopped Being Great. So was America great in 1984 when you first went there?
The idea of greatness and American greatness has always sort of struggled with the the contradictions of American history. I mean, you can always look at moments of American greatness and also reveal the ways in which America was not great at that moment. I mean, you think about the America that fought in the Second World War and defeated Nazism, but of course it was a segregated army that beat the Germans and the Japanese. You think about the 1950s, this extraordinary period of American modernization and American economic growth. But again, you know, that was during a segregated American South. But at least America seemed great to me in 1984. It really did. You know, the skyscrapers were sort of double the height of anything I'd seen in my hometown of Bristol. But it was really the sense of possibility, I think. I mean, you know, I managed to get to Cambridge and Oxford, as you said, but I came from a school where I was surrounded by pupils where upward mobility was not a given. A lot of people in Britain that I grew up with were kind of reconciled to a fate in a way that American kids just weren't. There was this sense that you really could pursue your dreams and achieve them. And it was that great optimism, that great belief in the American dream, as we call it, this belief that, you know, your kids will lead a more abundant life than you did, and that you will lead a more abundant life if you work hard and play by the rules. I found that so attractive. And, you know, just coming back to the present day, I mean, I came back to live in America about 8 years ago after a 10-year break. I'd covered the Clinton administration, I'd covered the Bush administration. And the thing that I noticed coming back in the later stages of the Obama administration was, you know, people just didn't believe in that American dream anymore. People didn't believe that their kids would lead abundant lives. People talked in much less ambitious language. They didn't talk about a dream anymore. They talked about economic security and the necessity of holding down multiple jobs in order just to make, you know, make their bills at the end of the month. I mean, when I came to California in the mid-80s, people talked about the nice-to-haves of middle-class life, you know, the extra car, the boat on the lake, the cruise in the Caribbean, the trip occasionally to Europe. You know, people just weren't talking about those things when I returned to America 8 years ago. And of course, when Donald Trump said the American dream is dead, Adam, I think an awful lot of Americans actually believed him.
Let's hypothesize a Nick Bryant 40 years older than you. I'm just wondering whether, you know, if you'd gone to America in the 1950s, you might have had the same exciting experience. But by 1984, perhaps you could have written the same sort of book that you've written now. Many people, as you know, on the left reacted to Reagan's election in 1980 and his re-election in 84, despite it being by a landslide, with the same kind of horror that people on the left reacted to Trump's election in 2016. It seemed like the ultimate sign of dysfunction and division, that a Hollywood B actor had somehow talked his way, connived his way into the White House. And there was the race baiting. There was the speech in 1980 where he kind of nodded and winked at white segregationism. So even in 1984, there were people in America who saw the Reagan dream as a really tawdry and not very convincing sham. But the Gipper, the charm of the Gipper worked for you. And over the years, it still seems that he still retains, almost more so as the years go by, some of that kind of twinkly charm.
Look, I separate the two. I mean, buying into the America that I fell in love with didn't necessarily equate with buying into the Reagan presidency. I remember one of the few occasions I ever remember my dad sort of raising his voice to me was when I kind of would sit in the car on the way to school sometimes and fear that Reagan was going to bring about nuclear Armageddon. I mean, there was a real concern about that in Europe at the time, wasn't there? And this kind of recklessness about Reagan, in the same way there were concerns about the recklessness of Donald Trump. And actually what the book looks at is how Reagan was actually, you know, a godfather of polarization. We saw him as this kind of unifying figure in 84, you know, the guy that won 49 out of 50 states. But if you look at the origins of polarization, Reagan is such a key character in the story. I mean, he first emerges, of course, in 1964 as an advocate of Barry Goldwater in that sort of disastrous election for the Republicans, but an election which kind of paved the way for their success later on. He opposed the great 1964 Civil Rights Act. He was very concerned about the sort of cultural, the counterculturalism that he'd seen in California. And he became, You know, he obviously made that huge breakthrough with the speech that he made on behalf of Goldwater. And then, of course, you know, you look at the Reagan presidency, and so many of the problems that America has right now stem from those times. I mean, I argue in the book, for instance, that he kind of created the modern day presidency. I mean, after he was the first president to actually successfully serve two terms since Eisenhower, and he kind of created the sort of model of the presidency, the modern day State of the Union with its kind of heroes in the balcony. That was a Reagan invention. The speech at times of national grief. I mean, his Challenger speech was just exceptional. But he created this presidency, Adam, that was very much based on the front office rather than the back office. It was based on a performative side. And I think that's been problematic over the years because obviously the sort of presidents that tend to emerge are performers rather than administrators. And the way that his presidency worked as well, I mean, obviously, you know, if you look at the big disparities in wealth in America, this income polarization, which is such a key part of the political polarization, I mean, that really opened up during the Reagan years. And of course, he was one of the great architects of the modern day conservative movement, bringing together the evangelical Christians, bringing together the National Rifle Association. He was the first presidential candidate they ever endorsed. I mean, Reagan really did create that. And he also turned Americans against government, Adam. I mean, that's crucial. You know, that inaugural address where he said government isn't the solution, government's the problem. And that paradigm really took hold. After the New Deal, of course, a lot of Americans looked to government as a welfare safety net, the builder of an amazing interstate highway system. After Reagan, faith in government really declined very sharply. And as you've seen most recently in COVID, you know, the legacy of that is still very profound.
So what are the elements of American decline? One of them is this political polarization. How much of the story is an economic story, though, as well? Because you were talking in the beginning about this sort of sense of possibility in 1984, which is partly about material acquisition, the extra stuff, the second car. How much is this a story really of economic decline? And perhaps the political polarization is the product of the economic decline.
I think that's a major factor. I mean, there are lots of reasons for Donald Trump's unexpected success in 2016. I do think he was not a historical accident. I think by then he'd almost become historically inescapable. And so many trend lines sort of converged and culminated in his candidacy. I mean, politically, the Republican Party had become essentially the anti-Obama party. It made perfect sense for them to go with a virulently anti-Obama candidate. You know, Obama hadn't managed to heal the racial divisions in America. Arguably, America had become more racialized. And again, it made sense for the Republicans to go with the untitled leader of the birther movement. You know, technologically, the new economy had placed in the hands of Donald Trump these weapons that he could use, Twitter, Facebook, ways he could bypass the media. And Trump himself had become a sort of media conglomerate in his own right. Residentially, it was this sorting, the big sort, as we call it, where like-minded people not only worship together, they live together. They actually sort out each other in residential neighborhoods. You know, culturally, we'd seen the sort of normalization of narcissism. We'd seen the success of reality TV. And who was the great proponent of that? Obviously, Donald Trump. So there are so many sort of trend lines. But I think the economy one is really key. This idea that political polarization has gone hand in hand with income polarization, there's a lot more academic research now, and more needs to be done, but it's pointing to that as a really big factor. And like I say, when Donald Trump said the American dream was dead, I think so many people believed him. You know, Bill Clinton had boasted about building a bridge to the 21st century, but if you lived in the Rust Belt or the old industrial heartland, it really felt like a bypass. You didn't feel like you were charging along the superhighway. You couldn't even navigate the new economy. And I think that's been a huge problem. And one, frankly, that has been exacerbated by COVID. You know, it's actually increased these huge disparities in wealth. It's actually made it harder, I think, for a lot of people to navigate the new economy and to find their place in the knowledge economy. And I think that has been a huge problem. And like you say now, if you look at the map of America, you get close elections these days that are actually comprised of thousands of landslides. So in some places, you'll almost get sort of 90% supporting one side and 10% supporting the other and vice versa, whether you're in a blue area or a red area. And so often, these political the political makeup of the country reflects the economic makeup of the country. You know, the places that are responsible for the most economic output nowadays tend to trend heavily democratic.
If what's driving this are wage stagnation, the fact that young people today are the first generation for several generations not to be able to expect a higher standard of living than their parents, increasing inequality in economic terms. Ultimately, isn't that driven by factors, hasn't that been driven ultimately by factors outside of the United States, by the liberalization of the Chinese economy in particular, over roughly the same time period that you're talking about, by the transition to new technology, the new economy, as you say. And these are global factors that, of course, have affected all industrial, now post-industrial economies. How much of this is actually an external story, stuff happening to America, which no American administration, no American political project could effectively have resisted?
It's a great question. I think a lot of people in America certainly felt like economic castaways in a globalized economy. You know, we see the first rumblings of sort of anti-globalization in the Seattle protests in, I think, 1999. You see them around the IMF spring meetings in 2000 and early 2001. So American workers were onto this, I think, before American commentators and American journalists. But I do think mistakes were made. I mean, we often look at the 1990s as this period of extraordinary peace and prosperity, but so many of the problems of the 21st century are actually pregnant in that era of peace and prosperity that was overseen by Bill Clinton. And I think one of the mistakes that Clinton made was to believe that the internet could regulate itself. There were so many startups failing in Silicon Valley that it did seem that the market was acting as its own regulator. And the failure of the Clinton administration to adequately regulate the internet, I think, has been something which America has paid a very heavy price for. And of course, at the same time as failing to deregulate the internet, Clinton famously decided to deregulate the banks. And of course, you know, he unleashed what Warren Buffett called these financial weapons of mass destruction, the derivatives, these confusing financial products that nobody really understood, that was such a key part of the subprime meltdown ahead of the 2008 Great Recession. And I think, you know, if you look at the sort of massive convulsions that have hit America this century, I kind of think of the 2000 election, which undermined faith in American democracy. You think of 2001, September the 11th, which undermined faith in American national security. And of course, 2008, which I think had an even more traumatic effect, the Great Recession, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which really undermined belief in the American economy. And I think, you know, America is still reeling from that. And nobody has quite figured out yet how to make the U.S. economy work for as many people as it used to work for in the past. I think that's a key difference between now and then. And I don't think that policy conundrum has yet been solved.
If one of the big global shifts that is the background to the story you tell in your book is the globalization and the technological changes that have gone alongside the rise of China, then the other big geopolitical story that is the backdrop to everything that you're saying is the end of the Cold War. So can you talk a little bit about the long-term unraveling of the lack of a clear enemy in the way that America had up until 1989?
A number of things happened at the end of the Cold War. As you say, America lost its common enemy. And I think that was problematic for the politics of this country, because so much of the patriotic bipartisanship that we had seen during the 50s and the 60s was based on trying to defeat communism. It was that ideological battle that brought the Republicans and the Democrats together so often. And one of the most marked characteristics about the post-war, early post-war period is how much cooperation there was between Republicans and Democrats. The complaint of Democrats on Capitol Hill, like Lyndon Baines Johnson and Sam Rayburn, who was the famous Texan Speaker of the House, was that they didn't obstruct the Eisenhower administration. The complaint was they offered it too much help. And when you look at things like the interstate highway system, a lot of the educational reforms of the 1950s, the spur for them was often the Cold War. Sputnik, of course, created this national panic, which led to sort of various educational reforms.
So that was the moment in the early Cold War when there was this great fear that the Soviet Union was ahead technologically because
exactly.
they got Sputnik into space.
One of the impetuses for the civil rights reforms of the 60s was the fact that the Soviet Union was scoring such a propaganda coup in these newly non-aligned countries, newly decolonized countries in Africa, who were, you know, deciding which side to go with. So, you know, that was the Cold War had imposed a discipline on American politics. That's what I'm saying. It had nurtured this sense of patriotic bipartisanship. We saw it even during the Watergate crisis. That was a surprisingly bipartisan enterprise. And a lot of that fell apart after the end of the Cold War. It was almost as if Washington became the new Berlin, the place where America fought its ideological battles. And another thing happened at exactly the same time, which was that there was a generational shift in American politics, the greatest generation. The lawmakers who'd fought alongside each other in the theaters of war in Europe and Asia, had the torch wrenched away, literally wrenched away from them by the baby boomers, whose formative years had been spent in the culture wars of the 1960s. And I think that was such a key moment. You know, if you'd fought alongside each other in a real war, the idea of having a political war in Washington just didn't make sense. I mean, certainly not a vehement and an ugly political war. But then people like Newt Gingrich came along and people like Bill Clinton came along. Clinton brought his war room philosophy from Little Rock, Arkansas to Washington. Gingrich thought, we haven't had a Republican House Speaker since the 1950s. And the bipartisanship that we're offering maintains the status quo. It just rewards the Democrats. We're never going to be the majority party on Capitol Hill while we pursue this kind of bipartisan agenda. So we'll become an opposition party. We'll fight them on every single thing. And of course, that became, that set this sort of new dynamic in Washington. So the end of the Cold War and the generational shift from the greatest generation to the baby boomer generation, which is still in charge, by the way, was very much a sort of key milestone moment in this path to polarization.
One of my early American encounters in the Clinton years is my memory of a line in his first inaugural address, probably the only memorable line in his first inaugural address. There's nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured with what's right with America. And I loved that line. I still love that line.
I remember that line too.
Seems to me that that's what you've lost faith in. You've lost faith that what he was saying there was true.
Not complete faith. I was on the Mall that day. I actually listened to that speech from Bill Clinton. I was a young student at the time. My then girlfriend, oddly, had worked on the Clinton campaign. Look, what worries me at the moment is, where does America find its common ground? How does it heal? Which is the overarching mission of the Biden administration. Because the fault lines are still so deep and the fault lines are still so angry. America can't agree about guns. It can't agree about abortion. Events that you would think would be unifying end up becoming accelerants of polarization. 9/11, there was a fleeting moment of national unity, but as the Bush administration conducted its war on terror and decided to invade Iraq, that unity started to fray. Coronavirus, you'd have thought, here's an opportunity to bring the country together. But no, it became even more divided as people argued over something as simple as a face mask. People argue right now over the playing of the national anthem before American football matches. Should that be an occasion for the take the knee protest? Everything has become politicized. When I came here in 1984, it seemed that very few things were politicized, but now everything is politicized. And I think that creates huge obstacles in the path of Biden's attempt to try and bring this country back together. I just do not see that happening. And of course, proof of that comes in the 2020 election, when 74 million Americans vote for Trump, having seen his presidency unfold over the previous 4 years, they clicked with great enthusiasm, in most cases, on the terms and conditions of his presidency. And he won 25 states, and he won 74 million voters. And had it not been for COVID, I suspect we would still be talking about a President Trump. That, again, underscores just how deeply divided this country has become.
Your host family back in 1984, in your account, were Republicans, are Republicans. And you, I think you say you in your book, you've stayed in touch with them. And obviously you've done a lot of reporting from among Trump voters and in the heartland of America. But you live in New York. And I wonder, it seemed to me that your pessimism was, if you don't mind me saying this, a very liberal pessimism. It seemed to me that your markers of decline, your identification of the moments when it was really clear to you that things were going wrong, were things that Democrats would spot as problematic more than that Republicans would spot as problematic.
I mean, I do think there is balance in the book. I mean, I'm going to argue that very strongly. I mean, this book obviously went through a BBC vetting process. And just as we've identified the ways which Reagan and George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush contributed to the rise of Donald Trump, so too do we, you know, lay accusations against Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, the book, I think, is very tough on Barack Obama. I think some of the people who are Obama fans who've read the book, you know, I think it's been too harsh on him. And certainly I don't avoid this idea of a kind of Puritanism of the left. I talk about how censorious American academic institutions have become now, how overly sensitive in some people's eyes they have become, how reluctant they are to host speakers who have a very different ideological viewpoint. You know, when I was a student in America, you know, campuses seemed to be far more self-confident. There was a clash of ideas, and they promoted that. I mean, that's not true to the same extent of American academia anymore. And I can well understand why many Americans would look at the hauling down of statues of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and the renaming of schools that are paying tribute to Abraham Lincoln as deeply problematic. I mean, it seems that the Confederate statues, I mean, that arguably is sort of easier terrain. But, I mean, there are many people in America now who want to kind of cancel George Washington. And I can well understand why that's a real red rag to the right.
And a strike at the heart of perhaps what has kept America together in the past, including through difficult times, such as in the Great Depression in the 1930s. And perhaps some of what you felt when you came to America in 1984, that sense that there was a collective, in the end, there was a collective project, that the Statue of Liberty stood for something because the ideals were honorable and worth fighting for. And I think what many people, not just, you know, the right as such, but many people who would once have considered themselves centrist, many people who have voted Democrat many times, feel deeply uncomfortable about in the present moment is what they see as this challenge from the left to those fundamental notions of what America exists for. You know, that if those woke warriors were to completely dominate American culture, then really what would be left of the American project if it becomes just another country as flawed and divided and as sinful as every other country?
I think what's become really noticeable over the last couple of years, actually, is just how much of American history remains unresolved and just how much of American history remains contested. I mean, obviously, race is the biggest one, the original sin of slavery, the awfulness of segregation, the unfinished business of the civil rights movement, which the civil rights movement never managed to tackle police brutality, which has obviously come to the fore after the death of George Floyd. But it's not just race. I think there's been so many other sort of aspects of national life, which, you know, you can trace their origins right back to the early days. I mean, you think of the Constitution as a model. You know, the Electoral College obviously has flaws. I mean, the Democrats have been winning the popular vote in election after election after election. I think 2004 was the last time the Republicans won the popular vote. And yet those don't translate necessarily into Electoral College victories. You look at the apportionment of power in the Senate. You know, the fact that D.C. statehood is still very much a real issue, the failure to give the capital of America any representation in the Senate when states like South Dakota and North Dakota obviously send four senators to Washington. America's role in the world, I mean, that has always been contested. What should be the way in which America projects its power? You know, that debate is still very live. And after the Cold War, I mean, it's never been a debate that has been resolved in a way. They've lost their organizing principle of foreign policy in the way that they've lost their organizing principle of domestic policy in many ways. And you know, so much of that history is still contested, and so much of that history remains unresolved. And this comes at a time when these sort of historical purity tests are being applied, which make the resolution of that all the more difficult.
And the institutional problems of the political institutions of the state seem to me to be the ultimate unreformability of the Constitution is the great structural problem with the United States. And in the past, on one big occasion, when the country was probably even more divided, including on geographical lines, than it is today, in the middle of the 19th century, the resolution was obviously a civil war, which led to the reconstruction of the Constitution through those dramatic post-war amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which essentially remade the Constitution. I mean, if it was France, we'd have called it the Second American Republic right after the American Civil War. But it's, again, a tribute to the fundamental underlying conservatism of American that even then they didn't do that. They just merely called them amendments to the Constitution despite their revolutionary import. But how, short of a civil war, can you create the circumstances in which you can restructure the Constitution in ways that might make political institutions more responsive than they are at the moment? I don't know. That's a rhetorical question. And I guess your book suggests that you can't see your way forward either.
Well, it is the constitutional catch-22. It is the inherent problem of the system. The founding fathers openly admitted that this was an experiment, not in mass democracy, an experiment in representative democracy, and that the Constitution was subject to change. But a kind of idolatry has emerged, as you know, around the founding fathers, this idea that the, you know, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution were sort of biblical tablets, that they had a sort of Quranic status and shouldn't be changed. And of course, that is a big problem. I mean, they set up a system in Washington that was really designed to stop things from happening as much as making things happen. And that's been a huge problem historically, whether it's been with civil rights legislation. I mean, it took most of the 20th century to get meaningful civil rights bills passed, 64 and 65. You know, you have that problem now with gun reform. I mean, if you're on the left, you'd say that there's been a problem with universal health care. It's crazy. People on the left would say that the richest country in the world hasn't got a universal healthcare system. And of course, one of the reasons it hasn't is because the way that the government was set up here and the power of the Senate to block things. And so, yeah, I do think, you know, I suggest in the book that, you know, America might need to have a constitutional overhaul, but it's almost impossible to have the constitutional overhaul that may be required.
I cheekily begun by saying that this kind of reads like a love story between you and America, which has been souring steadily. If it's a love story, though, what is the ending, Nick? Is it really that in the end you can't quite leave America alone, though? You fell in love in 1984. You're disillusioned. You're frustrated. You're not quite sure where the relationship's going, but you can't walk away, can you?
Well, I can walk away, and I will be walking away later in the year. We'll actually be leaving America. But, yeah, I'll still be thinking about America. I mean, most of my student and professional life have been sort of spent sort of thinking about this country. And I've got skin in the game now. I mean, we've got an American daughter. She was born during COVID. She was born during the New York curfew, of all things, when the George Floyd protests were unfolding literally outside of our window. Look, I have this enduring love of America. You know, I actually sat and watched Hamilton with my 8-year-old daughter the other day, and I ended up crying at the end of it, which shows a kind of a love of this country still, and an optimism about this country. And I hope I'm wrong. I mean, they always say that America is going to hell, but it never quite gets there. And perhaps that's true of this moment as well.
Nick Bryant, thank you so much indeed. This has been really good fun talking to you, albeit about a slightly stressful subject.
Adam, it's been my pleasure. It's been great fun. Thank you.
Nick Bryant's book is called When America Stopped Being Great, A History of the Present. At the end of our conversation there, Nick recalled the Black Lives Matter protests outside his New York apartment. But of course, they spread around the world. And that, I think, hints at one way in which America may still have the capacity to inspire a 16-year-old Brit, albeit for different reasons than it seduced the young Nick Bryant.
Black trans lives matter!
If you spend time in British universities, it's hard not to see the influence of the radical so-called woke America, with its uncompromising claims about structural racism and its bold vision of the atonement that needs to be paid for past and present sin. In the 1960s, young people in Western Europe marched against American imperialism while embracing the tropes of the countercultural American left. Today, too, America provides a source of both indignation and inspiration, seemingly in equal measure. You've been listening to The Last Best Hope, a podcast from Oxford's Rothermere American Institute. The producer is Emily Williams. I'm Adam Smith. Goodbye.